I will open the Senate Interim Committee on Rules for May 24th, 2010. We have a rather full agenda this morning, and at exactly about 9:45, we are going to go into public hearing and work session on executive appointments. Apologize to people that have been here for the last 15 minutes waiting that we're starting late. Since we're in public hearing, I do not have to have a quorum. This is an informational meeting, so the first item on the meeting is I'm going to open an informational meeting on the Oregon Government Ethics Commission rulemaking update. Mr. Burson, could you come forward and could you give us an update, and then I'd have a few questions.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for having me here today to give this update on the rules. I'd like to start off by saying that the administrative rules for the Ethics Commission were adopted on March 5th of 2010 and became effective on the 15th of March of this year. Public comment was received up until March 5th at 10 o'clock that morning by the commission. The commission meeting started at 9 o'clock. And the first hour was public comments on the rules before the commission actually started discussing those rules. The agency held a total of 3 advisory committee meetings or hearings for a total of 9 hours. Those advisory committee hearings were on 10/29, 11/10, and 12/14. The rules process actually started back in September 15th of 09, so it felt a little bit almost like a legislative session. It took about 6 months to get these done. It was quite an extensive process for the commission. The advisory group played a major role in the updating and writing of these new administrative rules to comply with the changes brought about by Senate Bill 30. The commission is planning annual updates as required by ORS 244-2904A-B. And just for a side note, while we're having a public hearing on this, you might have heard that the gift rules that have been challenged throughout the courts here in Oregon were also, there was a writ of, I'll probably mispronounce this, but it's certiorari in the Van Atta case with the U.S. Supreme Court. That writ was denied recently, and so The gift limits will stand. And that's really the end of my presentation, sir.
Okay. These advisory committee meetings, my guess is those included some of the stakeholders in terms of the representatives from the League of Oregon Cities, Special Districts, Association of Counties.
Chair Devlin, that is correct, and actually grew over time. Not just the people that you mentioned, but there's a school boards association. You talked about the league and the Association of Oregon County Special Districts Associations. We had a number of people that were stakeholders in this.
Okay. In that process, what do you think went well and what didn't go as well as it perhaps should have in terms of involving those stakeholders?
Chair Devlin, you know, it's hard for me to say what I think went well or what didn't go well. You know, it's a difficult process, as if you've been aware of, as trying to pass legislation with the Ethics Commission. There's just a lot of people that have a lot of kind of stake in this, and the best thing we can do is just include all those people and let them give their input. I think the things that went really well was that the advisory committee got a chance to look at a draft, saw what they didn't really like in that draft, and was able to actually participate in writing that. Now, people have said that I should have gone back and let them kind of begin the process by helping to write that original draft, but the problem that I had in the prior year or the prior biennium doing that was is we ended up spending the majority of our time in the advisory committee just trying to get that initial draft. At least with when I had an initial draft, we had a starting point and we were able to go from there. So there was it was a little difficult at first. But towards the last, I think we actually came down to one rule where there was still some dissension, and that was the rule on being able to sanction your people to travel underneath one of the gift exceptions. And the League of Oregon Cities on that March 5th meeting had actually testified that they would prefer that their elected leaders, city council and mayors, would have the ability to sanction their own travel. And what the commission showed them was is that underneath that rule, if each one of those bodies decide that they want their people to sanction their own travel, they have the ability under the rule to do that. In the absence of that decision being made, then they would need to follow the steps pointed out in the rule. So when you ask me what went well and what didn't go well, you know, it was a long process. I talked about it started in September. It didn't end until March. So that was a very difficult process. But what went really well was is when we got down to the very last day that we were actually going to pass those, out of all the rules that we changed here and the ones that we've added, there was really only one rule that any of the stakeholders had testified that they really didn't agree with. So I think that was a positive.
Okay. Another follow-up question I have is that now that the change in statute is in place, the rules are in place, the next step in terms of probably trying to work with local officials is the guide for to public officials that needs to be produced. What's your timeline and what sort of process are you going to use to involve these same stakeholders in producing that guide?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, as I talked about with the rules, it was a long, drawn-out process, and we took a lot of our Attorney General's time in helping us with that. Currently, the public official guide is with our Attorney General, just having her review that to make sure that it complies with the statutes. Once that comes out of the Attorney General's office, we will do a very similar process than we've done with the rules, is we will get the advisory group back together, we'll look at that draft, and we'll make those changes that they see fit. And most of the time, that's usually around examples that we have in there. What you have to remember about the public official guide is you have the statutes, which are difficult to understand. You have the rules. We're trying to make more clarification in the rules. When you get done the public official guide, that should be a guide that any public official can pick up and really understand how it affects them. And so we're really trying to write that guide at a level that people will be able to understand it. And so we always have some pushback from the Department of Justice because we're trying to take statute and put it into simple language, and they always want to kind of revert back to statute because that's where they're most comfortable at. But unfortunately, your normal public official probably would not get much benefit out of that guide.
When do you think the guide will be actually published?
I, Chair Devlin, I expect the guide to be published within the next couple of months. I would have hoped it would have been sooner than this, but it's actually been held up in review with the Department of Justice. And I've talked with our AAG, and she's assured me that it will be done very soon.
Once it's out of the AG's office and you have it, this issue about clarity is probably at the core of the whole mission here, in a sense, because obviously you are dealing with some public officials like the ones here in this meeting who spent months on the ethics statute versus a planning commissioner out there that the first time they've ever been exposed to it is they just got appointed last week and they need some guidance to what they can do and not do. How are you going to interact with the stakeholders in terms of trying to ensure clarity?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, you know, the public official guide is just another tool in that. And when I talked about the levels, you know, the public official guide comes down to another level. Probably the best level we have is the increased resource that the legislature has put into the commission as far as training goes. We have a couple of trainers that are working full-time, going around to many people and training many different groups. But we've also began a program underneath the iLearn program here with the state of Oregon that's creating these modules that will actually clarify a lot of these statutes and rules for people, and they can pull those up online at any time free of charge. And currently right now I think we have 5 or 6 modules out there. We were from executive sessions to the gift rules to the use of office to conflicts of interest. And this is what we really found has been super helpful to folks, because they can actually take that to their council people or their planning commissioners, these volunteer folks that come into cities and counties to try to serve their areas, and they can get pretty much instant feedback. What we found is once people actually take the island, and they also follow up asking us questions on things that they don't understand, and then we're able to update our iLearn module to kind of, we were able to see some flaws we have in there, we're able to update that, and so it's a really nice service for a public official throughout the state.
Any questions for Mr. Burson? Thank you very much for coming here
today. Thank you.
I'm going to close that informational meeting for hearing, and I'll go to a hearing on update of implementation of the 2009 and 2010 election laws and review of the May 2010 primary election. Mr. Pack and Mr. Trout.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, members of the committee, I'm Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. With me is Steve Trout, our State Elections Director. I'm going to turn this over to Steve to walk you through the primary election, some of the issues that came out through that, and a little bit about, we'll probably pinch hit on the implementation of election law changes, but we'll start with the primary, if that's okay with you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, good morning. Steve Trout, State Elections Director. Had our primary election last Tuesday, and we continue to process that and to tally ballots and deal with exceptions and different issues that have arisen, which is our normal process. Counties have 20 days after the election to certify the results to us, and so they're working feverishly to get that completed and to get the final official results to us. We have obviously a close contest for the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. I've just distributed some frequently asked questions that we've put together answers to as far as some of the different scenarios that may or may not arise, just so that it's clear what the answers are, what the process would be in the event that we end up having a recount. I'd be happy to answer any questions on that. Answer any questions on that, if you have any, or I can move on.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would like to hear the process if there is a recount.
Can okay. I get a clarification before that, if that's okay,
sure.
Senator Burdick? A recount under this process, would it be under the same percentage requirement as a normal recount, like in the general election? It's a very small percentage, and what would that number be in terms of actual number of voters?
Sure. So for an automatic recount, Mr. Chairman, for an automatic recount to take place, that's spelled out in the statute, it would have to be, the difference between the two candidates would have to be less than 1/5 of 1%, so 0.02.
Okay, I'm sorry.
0.20%. I'm sorry, one extra zero.
Okay.
Wait.
1/5 of 1%. And so, not to do math at this point, but currently we have 829,705 ballots cast statewide, but for the superintendent's position, we only have 694,794 ballots cast. So there's about 135,000 statewide that undervoted this contest so far. So that's that's to be included as well. So what we would do would take the current numbers of Ms. Castillo has 347,893 votes as of this morning to Mr. Maurer's 344,745, which currently is a difference of 3,148. Right now, that's about 0.45%. So it does not look like it's going to reach that threshold for an automatic recount provided by the statute. So then the second opportunity for a recount is a demand recount. Any candidate can request that. It doesn't matter how close the contest is. In this particular case, the major concern is one candidate receiving 50% plus one of the ballots of the votes for that contest in order to be elected here at the primary. If someone doesn't receive 50% plus one of the ballots, then the top two vote getters would move forward to November to face off there. The difference as we calculate it right now is that Ms. Castillo is 495 votes above that 50% plus one threshold.
Senator Burdick, it's okay if I go to Senator Metzger, and that way when we get to him explaining everything, we might be very expeditious here. Senator Metzger.
Well, thank you. I guess that's my question, Steve, because in your summary here, you're talking about it has to be one-fifth of 1% of the difference between the candidates. But then you have that other thing, is that candidate to be nominated, or have to be elected, has to have 50 plus 1. So... but there is nothing, at least according to in the frequently asked questions here, that one-fifth of 1% within that one-fifth of 1% of actually being elected doesn't seem to be a recount threshold. I mean, if Ms. Castillo was less than one-fifth of 1% to actually be elected, that doesn't trigger the recount. It's just the difference between the two. That seems to be kind of a conflict because we've established that this is necessary to be elected, but we're measuring two candidates as opposed to measuring the threshold for election.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, it starts to get complicated really fast. But yes, there is no automatic recount provision as it applies to the 50% plus one threshold.
So what is a? I mean, I guess I could do the math here with the numbers you gave me, but maybe you already have it. What is the percentage difference between the 50% and what Ms. Castillo currently has in terms of the percentage of 1%?
That doesn't matter, Mr. Chair. It's 495 votes that she's over 50
plus one. So, Mr. Chairman,
but as a percentage, it would matter based on the one-fifth of 1%, whether that would fall within that, if that was a standard.
Sure. It continues to change every time we add votes to it. The number of write-ins actually impacts one of those equations, but not the other.
Yeah.
Right now, Ms. Castillo has 50.07% of the vote to Mr. Maurer's 49.62%.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not an exact answer, but to say that she's 0.07% above 50% is as close probably a number as I could give you right now.
Okay. How many battles are still uncounted, do you estimate, in that race?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, it's hard to estimate right now because it's in the cleanup mode. There's probably about 10,000 ballots that have been returned, but we're in the process of processing those. We send out a letter to those where the signature doesn't match, and the voter has 10 days to return that, which would be the end of the week. We don't know how many of those are going to come back and be valid ballots that will be counted and how many will be rejected. They're going through every single ballot here at the end. It's cleanup time. And so they're the ones that usually have the most questions around them, and that's why it takes a little bit longer at the end to clean up these last few ballots. But they're going through individually assessing those. So we know that there's about 10,000 ballots that have been returned that have yet to be counted. Of those 10 to 12,000, we don't know exactly how many of those will end up being valid and how many will not be valid. So, you know, it's just one of the uncertain things of elections right afterward is that we can't get exact numbers, but we'll know for sure from the counties by the 20th day.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Okay. Can we go back to Senator Burdick's basic question, which is the process from now forward? Is that...
Yeah, I mean, I think my questions have been answered. Basically, there's two opportunities for this being recounted or going into November. One is if it falls below 0.5% difference between two candidates, and the other is if any candidate falls below 50% plus one.
Mr.
Or if
Chairman,
no
Senator
candidate Bird. Gets above 50% plus one.
That is correct, and either candidate can request a recount at any point, no matter where the numbers lie on either side of that line.
And Mr. Chair, if they request it, do they have to pay for it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, yes, for a demand recount, the requesting candidate would need to pay for the expenses of that recount. They're required in a statewide contest to recount the entire state would be an $8,000 deposit at the time they file that demand. The last statewide recount that we had ended up back in 2008, ended up costing, I believe, $113,247, and so we don't. I think that's probably a pretty good estimate as far as what it would take going forward this time.
And Mr. Chair, do you happen to recall what the change was in that last recount that we had experience with? Did it change the outcome?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, the outcome did not change. I don't know how many votes it changed. Unfortunately, I wasn't here and haven't had time to pull up that historical record. But in my experience, it is very rare that vote totals end up changing through a recount.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, we did look back at it was ballot measure 53 in 2008, and I think the vote change difference was under 100 votes statewide, so it's a very, very small number.
Thank you.
Okay. Follow-up to that, not to make this, well, first of all, if party requests a recount, they pay for the recount, but if they prevail, doesn't the state actually pay for the recount?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. So if the overall results change, not change in number, but if the result changes so that the candidate that was behind ends up being the candidate that's ahead, then they would have their money refunded and the state would end up paying for that, as they would for an automatic recount.
Yeah. Not to make this overly complicated.
Uh-oh.
But in determining this 50%, my understanding is obviously Ms. Castillo's votes count, Mr. Maurer's votes count, the write-in votes count in terms of determining the total number of votes. Now you have about 10,000, potentially 10,000 ballots out there. Once you accept a ballot, I would believe that would count. But if you reject a ballot, ultimately, does that count in determining the 50%? That ballot, if you've rejected the ballot that was cast.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, let me make sure I get the question precise, because it gets complicated. So the question is, if a ballot is rejected, say the signature doesn't match, the person had already voted, whatever circumstance that would be, the ballot comes back, is rejected, is that ballot included in the number to calculate the 50% plus one?
Yes.
And the answer is no.
Okay. So the underlying comment is stand by.
Oh, but Mr. Chair, that leads to another follow-up. If it's an undervote, it also doesn't count. The ballots be accepted, but there's an undervote, that also doesn't go toward the 50%.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, that's correct. So that's why I identified those 135,000 undervotes right now. We have 2,156 write-ins as of now, and so those are included in that calculation, but the 135,000 or so that undervoted, that's not included in that calculation.
Elections people having too much fun. How about write-ins that are not real people?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You want to take over, Barry?
You're doing a great job.
All right. So for write-ins, the statute is...
Mickey Mouse, Donald
exactly,
Duck.
Exactly, Donald Duck, all of those people that are there. And it's interesting that you know those votes may end up having to have an impact here because of the write-ins and impacted the 50% plus one. However, write-ins are not tallied officially and gone through to say how many are for Mickey Mouse, how many are for Donald Duck, unless the total number of write-ins is greater than the number for one of the candidates that is in the lead. So if the number of write-ins, if all of the write-ins were for one person and that number of write-ins exceeds the number of ballots for the winning candidate, then those would all be tallied. In this case, that's not the case.
So basically, to respond to your question, even if it's clear that it's not a real person, they still, if there's anything filled in that line, it still goes toward the 50% plus one calculation.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you want to go into some of the other areas you're going to cover this morning?
48% plus, what was that question? 0.459%?
Yeah. 400 and what?
495 votes.
Mr. Chairman, that's 495 votes above the 50% plus one threshold as we speak. Okay, I apologize. Your question was other issues from the election?
Yes, yes. And the elections laws that were passed in 2000.
And the election laws. So overall, Mr. Chairman, the election ran, it was very quiet early on. It was great. The Secretary and I went on
particularly quiet in Clackamas County.
Exactly. particularly in Clackamas County. I'll cover that in a minute. The Secretary and I went on a vote-by-mail tour and visited three counties in Washington County, Deschutes County, and Jackson County. Had some legislators, county commissioners, and other elected folks and media there just to explain the process and the complexities of everything that goes on. I think it was very well received. Overall, it was a smooth election. It was quiet the first week. Turnout was projected a little bit lower than we actually ended up having. I think we had quite a few more ballots at the end than we had expected, story. We had a county, and I'm going to get it wrong now. I believe it was Union County that had one of their tally machines go down and become inoperative on election day. And so, using backup plans that the counties have, able to get them a replacement machine and able to tally all their ballots and still be able to report on time. And so, it's nice to see the backup plans kick into action and work. You never want to have to go to them, but it was good to see that work. With respect to Clackamas County, I was there a week and a half ago, and it was very quiet that first week. They had a few days delay in their ballots going out, although it was still within the statutory prescribed time frame. They ended up processing their ballots and catching up with the rest of the state. And from my reports, there were no issues identified in the election process there as far as tallying the ballots. Obviously, there were some issues previously with an incorrect office being placed on the ballot that ended up necessitating a reprinting of the ballots for the county. But all of the ballots, the correct ballots went out to the voters, we have confidence that things were administered correctly and that the vote tallies in Clackamas County are indeed accurate.
And I guess we're going to go into the elections laws.
And then election laws. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Obviously, for the first time, March 1st, we turned on our online voter registration system. To date, we've had over 18,000 transactions conducted on the on that system, ranging throughout the age spectrum from 18, 17, up to people in their 90s. I think we've had 8 people in their 90s use the system to register or to update their registration. Have had a few issues where people We couldn't identify their driver, their signature from DMV, and so we were forced to, or it sent them down the alternative path, which is to print out a paper record and mail it in with their signature. Obviously, we have to have that signature. That's how we decide whether their ballots count or not. So far it's been smooth. There's a few things we're going to look at here now that the election is passed to see if we can make it simpler, easier to understand, identify any bugs that the counties or we have had to be able to make it easier for voters. But we're very happy with that and how it has been used. I'm trying to remember other legislation we had in the special. I'll turn it over to Mr. Pack.
Just a couple of quick comments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think the online registration system is a good success. We came in on time and under budget, which was good news in these times, although we continue to have, as Steve said, a few bugs in the system come up here and there that we'll be fixing as we move forward. We've heard anecdotally from people that used it, that it was very convenient, that it was quick. We've had folks, I had one person call me and say that his son registered from Israel and was very excited to be able to do that quickly and easily and still get his ballot. Also, when it comes to the Clackamas County issues and other issues where ballot issues need clarification, one issue that always came up was our overseas and military voters, and I wanted just to publicly thank the military department and General Caldwell, who cooperated very well with us in identifying affected voters and ensuring that those voters personally received updated information about any issues that they might have if there was confusion about receiving two ballots or any other confusion on the ballot. So I just wanted to put that plug out there for them. A couple other issues. House Bill 2005, as you'll recall, was the reforms to the initiative system that you passed in 2009. Some portions of that went into effect in 2009. The majority of it went into effect this year, and we're just starting to see some of those results. I think one of the key features there is the requirement for paid signature gatherers to turn their signatures in the 10th business day following the month that they collected. I think that's been useful to the chief petitioners to be able to track their progress more consistently as they gather. It obviously allows the public and the media to be able to track progress and see what issues may or may not be likely to get to the November ballot. It's also helped our staff smoothing out the workload in preparation for the 30-day verification deadline that we're approaching in about 6 weeks now. We also just would point out that one provision of that piece of legislation was a prohibition from collecting signatures as a volunteer at the same time you're being paid to collect signatures on another petition, and we are currently in litigation over that, so stay tuned.
Questions for Mr. Pack or Mr. Trout?
I'm going to blank on the name of the plaintiff.
Cooey,
thank you. A volunteer, a signature gatherer that is paid and also would like to volunteer.
On another petition,
yeah.
Thank you both for coming here today.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to go to our next informational meeting, which is an update on travel and conduct policies in the Office of State Treasurer. Mr. Bond, could you come forward? Mr. Bond, please take a few minutes to explain the issues surrounding this, what actions the State Treasurer's Office has taken and the State Treasurer, and then I'll see if there are any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks. Darren Bond, Treasurer Wheeler's deputy. As you're aware, the Oregonian did a piece on travel in the state treasury and identified some discrepancies in our travel policy and that the treasurer has acted on to remedy. We have made some immediate actions to address things for, you know, golf and entertainment. The treasurer has appointed an independent panel to review the travel policies. He's asked me and our chief audit executive to review and make recommendations on our travel policies from top to bottom, and we're in the process of doing that. We've made a number of changes as we went along that we've implemented immediately. The bulk of what we'll do will be reviewed by the panel. In addition, the Secretary of State has assigned a group of auditors to review our travel policies and the compliance of Treasury with travel policy, with the previous travel policy as written. And that is underway and should be winding up in the next couple of weeks. We expect to have the work of audits and the panel completed by early June, and then we'll issue our final report with the final recommendations for changes to the Treasurer and make all the changes at that time.
Can you characterize at all the reaction of the people who were advantage of these perks? You know, what's the reaction around the agency?
Well, I think generally the reaction to the changes is fine. The reaction to the coverage of the Oregonian has been, you know, stressful for the agency and for the staff particularly. To the best of our knowledge, as we've reviewed this, and I think as we're finding from the review from audits, staff complied with policy as was written by Treasury. I think it was a less than sensitive policy that Treasury had in place, and those are being, you know, those things are being corrected. We're trying to have a policy that is more sensitive to public perception, and so that's what the Treasurer's asked us to do, and that's what. I don't think, there were a few instances of, you know, big clerical error kinds of things in per diem that happened. But by and large, staff did comply. The issue really isn't with the actions of the people as much as it is with the, maybe in some cases, an ill-advised policy the Treasury had in place.
Yeah, I guess the thing that struck me when this all came to light is, how we, whether these lavish perks were used to in some way compensate for people's basic pay. In other words, are we paying people in the Treasurer's office competitively?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, no. These people are clearly paid under market. They're paid fairly well for state employees in Oregon, but they're clearly paid under market for the job that they're doing for us. The classic picture on the Oregonian of Phil Mickelson at Pebble Beach. This is where these private equity firms have their advisory board and annual meetings, because it's not just the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System that invests in these funds. It's the Harvard Endowment System, and it's Intel's pension fund and things like that. So they go to nice places because they want to have good participation at their annual meetings and at their advisory board meetings. So they have them in nice places. It's important that the state participate in these advisory boards. It gives us insights into the management of these funds. It gives us an opportunity to have a voice in the management of these funds. We actively negotiate for positions on advisory boards when we're investing the pension fund's money, because it would be imprudent of us not to do that. So this is where they're going to be. We've actually, our chief investment officer actually has had conversations with, specifically with Leonard Green and the Pebble Beach Resort, to ask them if they would have it at less ostentatious places, because it would make it easier for us to justify. And they said no, because when they've tried it, and they get less participation, and participation is important to them because they want the participation of their investors when they're, as they're managing these funds, which is laudable from them. It is also, I think, important to note that in these are partnerships that we're involved in, and these are partnership expenses. So the state of Oregon pays its share of the partnership expenses, irrespective of if I send a staff person to attend the advisory board meeting. We're going to pay the same amount, because if I don't have somebody go there, somebody else is going to have somebody go there. And I'm still going to bear the proportionate share of the partnership expenses just the same. So we need to participate. We do participate. Private equity has been the leading light in terms of return for the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System. Since the inception of the private equity program in the late 70s, the program has returned 16% to us. It has clearly benefited the state of Oregon tremendously.
One question that I had, and I believe that this has been addressed, and if you could affirm that, it would be beneficial. I know that the Oregonian concentrated largely to some degree on what might be considered, Senator Burdick has referred to as lavish. The part that actually concerned me as much, if not more, was, in a sense, the collection for expenses not incurred.
Senator Devlin, I can't speak directly to that. And that's part of, I think, the ill-advised policy. But I also believe it was a well-intended policy of Treasury. We did allow, if we didn't pay an explicit fee for a meal at an event, we did allow for an employee to seek per diem for that. The reason was that we send these employees to expensive locations. Routinely, that's where they travel. They're traveling to Manhattan and to London and to Hong Kong and to San Francisco. And if you travel on the federal per diem to these places, you are not making any money. In fact, routinely, you're going to lose money. You're going to be out of pocket on the trip. And the belief at Treasury was that, and this policy goes back for years. This is not a current new policy. It goes back at least to the Jim Hill administration, if not before that. The belief was that over time, this policy kept employees whole so that they weren't having to spend money out of pocket to travel on the state's behalf. Again, in retrospect, it was, I believe, ill-advised, but that was the basis of the policy. That has been changed, and if a meal is provided, then an employee cannot seek reimbursement, per diem for the meal. If they're traveling internationally, there's actually a separate sizable international incidentals per diem, and so we'll allow them to claim that but not claim the meal per diem. So.
Senator Metzger.
Yeah, Darren. It would just seem to me to make sense and would seem to clarify for everyone is, rather than even messing around with the per diem when you're traveling, that you just do real and actual expenses. So you don't have to worry about whether it's more than the per diem or left. And if it's an approved trip, that the Treasury picks that up, that whatever it costs, that's legit, we're going to reimburse it. And so no one worries about being out of pocket or whether that puts me over and under, and just do real and actual expenses. Wouldn't that just provide clarity and allow everybody to kind of do their job?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, yeah, it would. And it's actually something that we have and are talking about. And it's something that we are instituting for the Treasurer and for council members and things like that to travel. The problem is it's very administratively cumbersome to keep track of all of the receipts and turn them in and have them all reviewed. It definitely will increase our workload. And so we are determining whether or not it makes for it. I think that what we might do is, and again, this is all in a process of, a state of flux as we're going through this and reviewing it with the panel and the Treasurer. But we may do kind of a combination of the two, in that per diem is a much more administratively elegant way of managing this from a staff resource perspective. But for these instances when staff are traveling to Manhattan or London or someplace like that, where where the per diem is clearly insufficient, we're looking at allowing them to if they're, you know, for whatever reason, circumstances force them to go with a group of people to an expensive location, that they may be able to claim that directly. So it's one of the options we're looking at. So.
Anything additional? Seeing none. Thank you very much for coming
in
today.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, we are about 45 minutes ahead of schedule.
Well, amazing.
So what we're going to do is... we are going to recess until 9:20. We were going to start into interviews at 9:45, but by 9:20, staff is going to see just how many of the phone interviews we can get lined up and see how many people might be wandering around the halls so we can start the interviews and maybe finish a little bit early this morning. Mm-hmm. So we'll recess until 9:20.
We will reconvene the Senate Rules Interim Committee for May 24th, 2010, and we are going to go to our executive appointment session. And I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Barry Beiler to the Energy Facility Siting Council. If you please come forward, and if you'd state your name for the record, give us a little bit of your background and maybe 1 minute or so, and a little bit about your interest in serving on the Energy Facility Siting Council.
Hello, Senators. My name is Barry Beiler. I currently work with City of Boardman as Community Development Director. Interesting. My background, I've worked for the city for almost 30 years now. And before, prior to that, I was working in construction on public utilities, mostly water, wastewater, and things like that. But they're somewhat applicable to dealing with power lines and generating plants. I've also been doing for the city the environmental reviews and natural resource policies. And in the last 7 years, all of the land use actions that the city of Boardman does. So all of those play into the Energy Facility Siting Council, and and I have a genuine interest in following what's going on with renewables and dispatchable baseload power, which is we've been dealing with in the Boardman area for quite some time. So,
okay. Any questions? Well, thank you very much for coming this.
You're lucky.
Coming this long distance.
You can talk your way into some questions, but.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Quite welcome, and
thanks for willing to serve.
Just so everyone understands, we will go through all the interviews before we actually go to one overarching motion to take action on the appointments here today. Closing that public hearing, I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Melanie Morin to the State Board of Massage Therapists. Good morning, Ms. Morin.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. My name is Melanie Morin. I'm a licensed massage therapist and instructor of massage therapy, currently residing in Tigard, Oregon. And I've been in the massage field here in Oregon since 1998, and been teaching in the industry for about 6 years. I have my own practice, and I've dealt in a lot of the actual part of the therapy of the therapist and teaching people how to be good therapists. So I would welcome an opportunity to sit on the board and use my background and experience to further promote this field, and I thank you for the opportunity to come and testify before you today. Be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions for Ms. Morin? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here today.
Yeah.
We'll take action on your appointment a little bit later. Okay. I'm closing that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Davis Moore Achi to the State Parks and Recreation Commission. Okay, Mr. Morachi?
Yes,
If you could give us a little bit of your background and why you want to serve on the State Parks and Recreation Commission, get just a couple of minutes, and we'll see if there are any questions.
Chair Devlin and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to participate in this hearing. My name is Davis Moriuchi, M-O-R-I-U-C-H-I. I reside at 227 Southwest Houston Avenue, that's Portland, Oregon, 97205. I'm interested in serving on the Oregon State Parks and Recreation Commission to help maintain and expand one of Oregon's outstanding park systems. For both present and future generations, me preserving and enhancing opportunities for the great outdoors is critical to preserving and enhancing the quality of life in Oregon.
This one.
I believe my 34 years of public service working for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers will help me actively to the efforts of the commission. During my career, I worked on a wide range of water and related land resources issues, and I learned the critical importance of taking a very long-term view of when making current-day decisions about our natural resources. And I think I would bring this perspective to my role as a commissioner. Thank you again for this opportunity in the hearing, and I would be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Seeing no questions from the committee, thank you very much for appearing here today by telephone. We will take action on a recommendation to the full Senate a little bit later in this committee hearing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Close that public hearing. Open a public hearing on the appointment of Donna Kane to the Oregon State Board of Nursing. Ms. Kane?
Yes, this is Donna.
Hi, Ms. Kane. If you could just give us a brief overview of your background and your interest in serving on the State Board of Nursing, it'd be appreciated. Just a couple of minutes.
Sure. Are you ready now?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. I've worked at Rogue Valley Medical Center for about 11 years, and prior to that, I've had all kinds of experience as far as taking care of my own bedbound mother and failure to thrive babies, and my whole life has really consisted of caring for other people. And it's important to me to see people cared for properly, and I believe with my experience, I have supporting in, I take patients to various procedures in the, throughout the hospital, and I work in critical care unit. So I believe my background is probably about equal to any CNAs that you might come across. And I really think that we need somebody who does care about people, not just treat them as though they were, well, unimportant. To me, all life is very important.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Kane? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Kane, for appearing here this morning via telephone. We will take action on your appointment a little bit later in this meeting.
Thank you.
Close that public hearing. Open a public hearing on the appointment of John Tess to the Trust for Cultural Development Board. Mr. Tess?
Yes, Chairman Devlin.
Mr. Tess, if you could just state your name for the record and give us a couple of minutes on your background and your interest in serving on the Cultural Development Board.
Chairman Devlin, members of the committee, my name is John Tess. I reside at 2874 Northwest Cumberland Road, Portland, Oregon. I represent the Historic Preservation Community. I'm currently president of Heritage Consulting Group. It's a nationally recognized historic preservation consulting firm with offices in Portland, Philadelphia. Over the years, I've watched Oregon Historical Trust and have been impressed with the work that they've done since their inception in 1999, but realize that they have a way to go to get the amount of money that they want to move forward. Oregonians, I think, have always had a strong sense of place and heritage. I think that historic preservation plays an important role in that heritage. I'm proud to be asked to serve on the committee. I'm the cultural trust. I believe that my experience at the local, state, national levels of historic preservation can help support and grow the trust and its mission to preserve, strengthen every aspect of Oregon culture. I have two kids that are dancers, so I know how important it is to support the arts. One of them is a professional dancer now. And so, again, I'm very proud to be asked to serve. Sorry I'm not able to be there in person today and would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Tess? Well, Mr. Tess, thank you very much for appearing here via telephone this morning. We will take action on your appointment a little bit later this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I will close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Jody Roth to the Commission for the Blind. Ms. Roth?
Yes, this is me, Jody.
Hi, Ms. Roth. This is Senator Devlin, and I'm here with Senator Metzger and Senator Burdick. This is the Rules Committee. What we'd like you to do is just state your name for the record, talk to us for a minute or two about your background and your interest in serving on the Commission for the Blind.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Jody Ross. I reside at 5905 Northeast 37th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97211. And I'm looking to represent the Commission for the Blind. And I am, excuse me?
No, we can hear you.
Oh, perfect. Okay. I'm interested in serving on the commission because I believe that training and education is the key to promoting independent living. I have been the visual impairment services coordinator at the Portland VA Medical Center for the last 10 years, specifically providing education training to our legally blind veterans to promote independent living in the community. Through this, I've had to collaborate with the Oregon Commission for the Blind offices and have come to recognize the work they do in the state to enhance independent living through job skill training and or activities of daily living training. I believe that the commission has a responsibility to provide these services to all of our eligible citizens in Oregon. And I look forward to providing guidance and oversight to ensure that the Commission for the Blind remains a resource for our state and the clients and future clients that they serve. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Roth? Seeing none, thank you very much for appearing here today via telephone. We will take action on your appointment a little bit later this morning.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Close that public hearing. And I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of William Bard to the Long-Term Care Advisory Committee. Mr. Bard, by now you know the routine. So.
Yes, I had a little rehearsal now. Thank you. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Bill Bard. I live at 2555 Southwest Sunset Boulevard in District 18, Southwest Portland, 97239, and I am seeking confirmation of my appointment to the Long-Term Care Advisory Committee. I moved to Oregon from Texas 8 years ago this month, and I've served as a certified ombudsman volunteer for the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman for nearly 3 years. In that time, I've learned a lot about the issues facing elders and their families as they experience the various living options that declining health and circumstances may impose. In my case, I was privileged to provide round-the-clock care and supervision of my aged mother for the last 5 years of her life in our Oregon home until her death at age 91 in 2006. I was impressed with the variety of long-term care options available in Oregon, but I saw firsthand the importance of the work that certified ombudsman volunteers do in providing advocacy from a resident-centered viewpoint for those who must make their home in one of these facilities. I hope that my perspective as an active volunteer will be helpful to the Long-Term Care Advisory Committee as it provides oversight and support to the state long-term care ombudsman in what are surely to be challenging times ahead. A burgeoning elder population in Oregon plus serious financial pressures on state programs require that we accomplish our mission and keep our commitments to the fragile population with careful diligence and cost effectiveness. The contribution of well-trained volunteer citizen advocates meets both of these goals and is the basis of my interest in this appointment. Thanks for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Bard? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here today, and we will take action on your appointment a little bit later.
Thank you, Chair Devlin.
Thank you.
And I'll see you on the street. I live walking distance from
you. Let's walk the dogs. Thank you, Stephanie.
I'm going to close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Kent Barker
and Scott Stanton
to the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Barker.
Yes, sir.
If you'd please talk to the committee, you're here before Senator Devlin, Senator Burdick, Senator Farioli, and Senator Metzger. Talk to us a little bit about yourself. We know you're being appointed to the BPSST board and your interest in serving.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Chair Senator Richard Devlin and other members of the Rules Committee. My name is Kent Barker. I'm the Chief of Police in Puyallup, Oregon. I've been the Chief for just a little over 6.5 years, and I've been on the Police Policy Committee for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training for the last 2 years, and I've requested to be appointed onto the actual board for the Police Standard Safety Training Center, and I just request your support, and I'd be happy to answer anyone's questions.
Okay, Chief Barker, I'm trying to stay a little distant from this since you're my chief.
Okay. I apologize, I cannot be there in person today.
Any questions for the chief? Seeing none, thank you, Chief Barker. We'll take action on your appointment a little bit later this morning.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Stanton.
Hello, Senator Devlin, committee members. My name is Scott Stanton. I'm the Assistant Fire Chief at the Hermiston Fire District, and I've been in the Oregon Fire Service for 24 years, and I'd like to represent the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association on the board and hope to promote continued professionalism in the Oregon Fire Service.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Stanton? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. More of a statement, not a question. In vast areas of rural Oregon, it's the volunteer firefighters and the volunteer EMTs that provide virtually all of the first responder services. And it's just one of those situations where I think they're underappreciated. Most folks don't encounter them unless there's an emergency. The training requirements are high because there's continuous pressure to professionalize firefighter services and emergency medical technician services. And it's a very fast track to keep our volunteers on. So I'm very gratified that we'll have quality representation from an Eastern Oregon community to help try to balance the need to meet the service requirements, but also to keep our volunteers from burning out and losing heart because the training requirements are very rigorous. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think Senator Farioli's statement has the concurrence of all the committee members here. We know actually we don't have to go only a few miles outside of the city of Salem to start finding volunteer fire departments. It doesn't take but a few miles. Any additional questions from Mr. Stanton? Thank you very much for appearing here today. We will take action on your appointment a little bit later this
morning.
Thank you. I will close that public hearing. And I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Sharon Van Eaton to the Nursing Home Administrators Board. Okay. Ms. Van Eaton?
Yes, sir.
Hi, Ms. Van Eaton. If you would please state your name for the record, talk to us for a minute or two about your background and your interest in serving.
Sure. So, Chair Devlin and members of the committee, my name is Sharon Marie Van Eaton. I am currently residing at 3120 Northwest Kingston Way in Albany, Oregon, 97321. I represent Pacific Retirement Services, which is based out of Medford, Oregon, and I'm currently serving as the Health Services Administrator for our new facility, Mirabella, Portland. My reasons for wanting to serve on the Board of Nursing Home Administrators has to do with the passion that I feel for the long-term care industry, as well as wanting to give back to the board that has made my life-enriching career possible. I can offer the board dedication and commitment, along with the notion that I will take this position extremely serious. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those now.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Van Eaton? Seeing none,
Thank you, Ms. Van Eaton, for appearing here via telephone this morning. We will take action on your appointment a little bit later.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Close that public hearing. And I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Kay Reitland to the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board. Ms. Reitland, if you would please state your name for the record, talk to us for a minute or two about your interest in serving on the State Hospital Advisory Board.
My name is K-A-Y-M Reichlin, R-E-I-C-H-L-I-N. I am a psychiatrist at Oregon State Hospital for the past 23 years, and I'm quite interested in seeing that the hospital continues to improve. I would like to be helpful to the OSH Advisory Committee by providing any information they need from a physician who actually works on a ward. There are several other physicians that are usually present at those meetings, but they are administrative physicians who are not currently doing ward work. I really just want to be of assistance in whatever way I can continue to help the hospital improve.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? I had a question, and not to actually put you on the spot, but obviously there have been a number of transitions at the state hospital. What do you think is going well, and what do you think, I know I'm putting you in a difficult position, could be going better?
Well, there are, of course, a number of things that could be going better. We have some very difficult patients in certain areas of the hospital, and the kinds of difficulties vary from one part of the hospital to another. And we need gradually to change the climate of the hospital from forensic or, you know, more jail-like to more recovery-oriented. And I support that plan. I think all the physicians support that plan. It's a very difficult transition because the people who are least sophisticated and least trained in the hospital have the immediate contact with the patients. And so the newer they are or the more in the old style that they are, the harder it is for them to respond in ways that are recovery-oriented. So the change in the hospital really has to begin from the very bottom level of staffing and work its way up, and it's a difficult change in an institution of this size. We have many, many, many employees, and I'm sure you've all heard about the mandates, which also make the staff tired and angry about being mandated when they don't plan on it, and we just have to have a different kind of staffing. I think our superintendent spoke in the last advisory committee meeting about needing to be able to staff in a way that would allow coverage of vacation days, sick days, and furlough days so that actually there would be a little excess staffing allowed to do that. But we don't have that kind of staffing, which is used in private hospitals because we have physician authority only. It's the number of physicians rather than just managing the budget in the most efficient way possible, is what she said.
Okay. Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for appearing here today via telephone. We will take action on your appointment a little bit later this morning.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I'll close the public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Joseph Siebert to the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training. Mr. Siebert, if you would come forward, identify yourself for the record, and talk to us for a minute or two about your background and your interest in serving.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Seibert. I live at 32399 Southview Drive in Lebanon, Oregon, and I'm currently a fire captain for the City of Eugene Fire Department. Over the past year, I've served as a member of the Fire Policy Committee, also DPSST Committee, a subcommittee of the board, and recently was approached to possibly be appointed to the actual board of the DPSST, which I was very honored. Kelly Bach, the president of State Firefighters, actually asked me if I would represent the state firefighters at this level. And like I said, I was very honored to take that appointment. I made a long laundry list of reasons why I wanted to be appointed to this committee, and I kind of narrowed it down to three more important ones, really. Number one is just to set good policy, good enforceable policy for all the public safety officers of the state of Oregon. Secondly, to be an advocate for public safety and the safety of those officers, and to maintain the professionalism of our officers. Thirdly, and most importantly, I think, is to protect the public trust. We all work very hard every day. I think we're kind of ambassadors to the public trust every time we're on a call every day, that type of thing. And I would really like to maintain that and, you know, make sure essentially that the right people for that are wearing our uniform are the people that actually should be doing that. I think there's we've had some recent history in other states, luckily enough not ours, where we've discovered later on that we've had the wrong people with criminal records actually acting as public safety officers. So, those are the three main things I would like to try to convey to you today. And really, I would just like to thank you for the opportunity to hear me today and consider support in this area. And I would be glad to answer any questions that you would have.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here today, and we'll take action a little bit later this
Great.
Morning.
Thank you very much.
I will close that public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Roxy Mayfield to the Home Care Commission. Ms. Mayfield? Oh, she's on. I didn't know she'd be on. Ms. You all have better technology in your own homes. Ms. Mayfield?
Hello.
Ms. Mayfield, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, Ms. Mayfield, if you would please state your name for the record and tell us a little bit about your interest in serving on the Home Care Commission.
Well, I am a person with a disability, and I have employed home care workers for many years, and I am a rehabilitation counselor by profession, and I make up this thinking that all individuals have quality.
Okay. Any questions? Hearing none, thank you very much. We will take action on your appointment a little bit later this morning.
Thank you very much.
Close that public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Linda Brown to the Teacher and Standard Practices Commission. Ms. Brown, if you would come forward, state your name for the record, and talk to us for a minute or two about your background and your interest in serving on the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As you said, my name is Linda Brown, and it's important to remember that success isn't measured by inputs alone, but the better the input, the more likely that the desired results will be obtained. Through my 9 years of service on my local school board, I know that the input, the impact for a child of a highly qualified, motivated, and motivating teacher is the overwhelming difference maker for a child. So I look forward to this opportunity to assist in providing educators who are ready to make our children in Oregon successful.
Any questions for Ms. Brown? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming
this morning.
And we'll take action on your appointment just a little bit later.
Thank you very much.
I will close that public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Michael Fieldman to the State Housing Council. Mr. Fieldman.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you regarding my appointment to the State Housing Council. As you mentioned, my name is Michael Fieldman, and I reside at 415 West Elizabeth in Roseburg, Oregon, and I'm the Executive Director of the United Community Action Network, or UCAN, which provides a variety of services to people in need in Douglas and Josephine counties with offices both in Roseburg and Grants Pass. I'm really honored and excited to be nominated to serve on the State Housing Council. I've been involved with operating programs that provide affordable housing and or with the development of affordable housing for over 25 years, including UCAN receiving the National Maxwell Award for Excellence in Affordable Housing, which is awarded by the Fannie Mae Foundation. In addition, I've had over 35 years' experience in providing social services to people who reside in affordable housing. Because of this, it's my experience that the combination of stable, affordable housing and service support is really the most effective way of stabilizing people's lives and to get them to a place where they can, where they no longer need help, even to the point at often of realizing home ownership. And this is a concept known as Housing First. I see the membership on the Housing Council as being an opportunity to further enhance efforts to bring more affordable housing to those who need it. I think my extensive experience with both affordable housing development and provision of social services will provide a unique perspective to the Council and to further efforts towards expanding the Housing First model. I look forward to the opportunity to work toward giving more Oregonians a chance for affordable and decent housing. Thank you again for this opportunity to testify before you. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to respond.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Fieldman? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here this morning. I will close the public hearing, opening a public hearing on the appointment of C. Lane Borg and Ann Lineger to the Alcohol Drug Policy Commission.
Morning, Senator Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Lane Borg. I'm the Executive Director of Metropolitan Public Defenders. And I just wanted to talk to you today about, or say today that my interest in serving on the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission is that, if anything, that I've become convinced over the last 25 years or so of being a criminal defense lawyer, but also being involved with working for the courts, working in at the public defender's office, and also being in private practice, is that the best public policy is made when there's a collaborative effort by a structured group to represent all interests so that you can try to determine what the barriers might be to implementation of that policy. And so I feel that I look forward to playing that role and being the, as I understand it, the criminal defense lawyer designee on this commission to see if we can figure out the best way to do that, because alcohol and drug policies have an amplified effect on other, so many other agencies, including DHS, in the criminal justice system, public safety, and so I'm really looking forward to this. And I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Okay. We'll go to Ms. Lineger first.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I'm happy to be here today. I'm Ann Lineger. I'm a Clackamas County Commissioner, and Clackamas County's primary business office is 2051 Kane Road in Oregon City. The reason that I applied to be the commissioner representative on this commission is because I care very much about strong families. And I think we all realize that addictions really jeopardize strong families. 55% of the kids who are removed from home because of abuse or neglect are in families where there are addictions. 70% of the people who are incarcerated in Oregon struggle with addiction issues, and addiction also influences domestic violence situations. Before I joined the Board of County Commissioners, I was a program officer and director of program-related investing at the Meyer Memorial Trust. And there we looked at a lot of program models, including ones for addiction recovery programs. I'd like to bring that underwriting efficiency experience and my knowledge of the county's social service programs and addiction recovery needs to serve effectively to help us provide treatment options to addicted people in Oregon, in the whole state of Oregon, and also be ready for when 30,000 more people have access to drug treatment benefits when health care legislation rolls out in 2014. Thank you. I'd be delighted to answer any questions.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you both for coming here this morning, and we'll take action on your appointments a little bit later.
Thank you.
And apologize if I actually mispronounced your names. I think it's one of the qualifications for this job. Close that public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Aletha Bonebrake to the trustees of the State Library. Ms. Bonebrake, please.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, thank you for considering my nomination. My address is 2347 Campbell Street in Baker City, Oregon, and I'm interested in serving on the Oregon State Library Board of Trustees because I have been deeply involved in the Oregon library community for over 25 years at all levels of service. I was the librarian in Baker County. I have been retired for 3 years, but continue to be involved in the community in various aspects. I was the past president of the Oregon Library Association. I feel very strongly about our state library and the dynamic services that it provides to the state legislature, the digitizing of resources, which will help bring materials and content into our rural communities, also the service they provide to blind and print-impaired people in our state, and they're currently migrating to a digitized service which can bring the service from 5,000 up to about 50,000 people at a much easier level of self-service. And then, too, for our young people, and the public libraries serve profoundly in the isolated communities where school libraries are being decimated, you might say, and the public libraries are stepping up to meet the needs of our children, and the state library is deeply involved in development issues, and I want to be a part of this future. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Bonebrake? Yes. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, I just would like to recognize Ms. Bonebrake is one of Oregon's leading advocates for literacy and content. So she's going to be a real addition to this commission.
I want to thank you for that.
Any additional questions or comments? Thank you very much for appearing here today. We'll take action on your appointment just maybe an hour or so from now. Okay. Who do we have?
Phyllis is here. Maureen's on the phone, and then we'll have to get some more on the phone next.
I'm opening a public hearing on the appointments of Phyllis Harris-John, Samara Stone, Lorraine Wilson to the Commission on Black Affairs.
Good morning, Chair Devlin and other committee members. I'm Phyllis Harris-John of Portland, Oregon.
Please proceed.
Okay. And I'm here to ask for your support of my nomination on the Oregon Coalition of Black Affairs. I'm Oregon homegrown, and I'm really excited about being able to serve my community at this capacity and from this venue. I've been involved in the immediate Portland community in various capacities. Had a chance to get my feet wet in the world a little bit, Peace Corps and living in other states, but something has drawn my heart back to my community where I feel like I have a lot to offer. And there are a lot of immediate goals I would like to meet, basically bridging problems that have existed in the past and problems that exist today among youth and then older generations. So I feel that I'm at the perfect opportunity to bridge those gaps, and I hope that you'll support me.
I'm going to go through the next two, and then we'll come back for questions.
Okay.
Although that may not be entirely possible, because two of them will be by phone. So.
Ms. Wilson.
Ms. Wilson? Yes?
This is Senator Devlin, and I'm here with Senator Farioli and Senator Burdick, the Senate Rules Committee. If you'd state your name for the record, talk a little bit about your interest in serving on the Commission on Black Affairs.
Okay, my name is Lauren Wilson. I currently live in Eugene, Oregon. I have been in the state of Oregon for the past 10 years, an immigrant and a citizen. My interest in serving on the Commission on Black Affairs is because I see so much potential with Oregon with regard to serving its citizenship. And I've been employed in several different places, and most recently I'm currently employed at the University of Oregon. And one of the things that I'm currently seeing, and everyone is talking about, is that achievement gap, and in focusing on recruiting minority students and students who are underrepresented on campus. And it has been a struggle with me during the time at the university why, it's so difficult to achieve this. And I want to focus on the future. I keep telling people the future. I want to focus on changing the future. And to change the future, I see that in our kids, in Oregon's kids. Because when all citizens of Oregon are productive, then Oregon becomes a successful state. So it's my focus on the youth and reducing that achievement gap. But most, I think one of the ways I see of achieving that is reinstilling that self-worth in our kids. From the statistics that we currently have, it shows that between somewhere during grade, third grade, we lose our kids. And I think it's because of that self-esteem where our kids are being shown in some way that they're just not good enough. And I want to change that because it takes someone believing in themselves to know that they can do anything. So that's one of my reasons for applying to be on the Commission of Black Affairs, because African American students are one of the groups that is overrepresented in that area, but not only for African Americans, because whatever we do for one group can be duplicated and certainly can impact everyone's Oregon, which is the ultimate goal.
Ms. Wilson, we also have here Ms. Harris-John. I'm going to see if the committee has any questions for either of you. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you both, actually, for appearing here this morning. We will take action on your appointments just a little bit later.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Samara Stone?
This is she, yes.
If you'd please state your name for the record and actually talk to us for a minute or two about your interest in serving and your background.
Okay, so my name is Samara Stone. Do you want me to spell out my last name?
No, we have it on record. Please just talk to us for a minute or two about your interest in serving and your background.
My interest in serving is because I'm aware of the many injustices and areas of advocacy within the African American community, such as education, healthcare, and child welfare. I realize that a lot has been done to bring awareness of the challenges that African Americans face here in Oregon, and I would be honored to be a part of a commission that is willing to work to improve these disparities. I have a background in social services right now. I currently work as a registered counselor at St. Mary's Home for Boys. I also am a CASA volunteer, and I also work at a treatment center for Volunteers of America. And so I would bring those strengths to this advocacy commission.
Any questions? Hearing none.
Sorry, my phone is fading out.
Okay. Thank you very much for appearing here this morning via telephone. We will take action on your appointment a little bit later.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Close that public hearing. For the sake of the people in the audience, the process here is actually a lot more involved than it appears. Obviously, there's a lengthy process on the executive branch side, and in terms of people expressing interest or the governor's staff approaching them, wanting them to express interest. And as these nominations are put forward, and the governor has forwarded these to the Senate for confirmation, the Senate hears about these nominations. The committee chair receives them first, then the committee members, then all the members of the Senate. They have all actually received this information. They all have the background information on every one of the applicants. And so the final end of the process is almost the end of the process, is this committee hearing, and then finally the Senate action on the appointment themselves, whether to confirm or not confirm. We do not have that many interviews today. We only have 45. I think the record for the committee this year is about 120. So,
and Mr. Chairman, you might add that it's only the new appointees that are requested to appear.
Yes. And when, thank you, Senator Farioli, and when we say 120, that was the new appointees.
Well,
and then. And we also have a number of appointees who are reappointments. And for reappointments, if there's any question by any member of the Senate, then we ask for the person to come forward and to appear. If they're in a paid position, they will always appear before the committee, even in a reappointment. I'm going to go on and close that public hearing and opening a public hearing on the appointment of Eric Anderson to the Board of Boiler Rules.
Chairman Devlin, distinguished senators, my name is Eric E. Anderson. I'm a professional engineer currently residing at 1092 South Redwood Street in Canby, Oregon. I'm a small business owner, Anderson Engineering, have been for over 20 years. Been in the profession of boiler and pressure vessel engineering and design for at least 25 of those years. Currently a member of the Oregon Boiler Pressure Vessel Association, which is a public safety organization that focuses on the issues that revolve around boiler and pressure vessel safety rules and laws. I was approached by a number of members of this particular association to continue on with promoting the excellence in the technical aspects of boiler pressure vessel design, construction, repair, alteration, testing, and inspection. And I honestly believe that safe boilers are good for the public's interest. We know that what can happen when these types of pieces of equipment that are used in the industry, very common, especially in laundromats and schools and things of that nature, when they get into disrepair, what effect it can have on the public safety and confidence. So I do honestly believe that the whole process does need to be regulated and it does need to be maintained by people that are qualified, and I appreciate the opportunity to be used in that capacity. Do you have any questions that I might be able to answer?
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Anderson? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here this morning.
Thank you.
I will close that public hearing, opening a public hearing on the appointment of Gregory Nelson to the Building Code Structures Board.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Gregory Nelson. I currently reside at 22282 Northeast Park Lane in Fairview, Oregon. For the last 7 years or more, actually, I've worked for Portland General Electric. I'm a mechanical engineer. I work with our customers around energy efficiency. I help them prioritize their decision-making, make sure they're aware of various programs, be it the Energy Trust of Oregon, state tax credits that will help them implement capital projects to improve their energy efficiency. If they are not able at this time to pursue capital projects, I often help them use their existing systems in the most efficient manner, making sure they are aware of energy efficiency strategies that they can implement in their facilities. In this regard, I see serving on the board as basically an extension of that opportunity to work with PGE's customers and other customers throughout Oregon. At this time, I'd like to open for any questions you have for me.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Nelson? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here this morning, and thank you for your willingness to serve.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we have Mr. Harvey here. Close that public hearing. Open a public hearing on the appointment of Alton Harvey to the Oregon Board of Dentistry. Mr. Harvey? Please begin at your leisure and state your name for the record.
Yes, sir. Senator Devlin and this honored commission, this honored Senate body, I thank you for allowing me to appear before you. My name is Alton Harvey, and I use senior. That could be twice. I reside in Beaverton, Oregon, 15005 Southwest Kingbury Drive, and I've lived there 13 years with my wife and for 49 years and my daughter and two grandchildren. We moved from Chicago, Illinois. My dad moved to Chicago in 1950. I'm a former sharecropper of Georgia. And I've served extensively in public service. I've realized my calling for service at a very young age, so I started to prepare myself for those endeavors. I serve on the Beaverton Human Rights Advisory Commission for 13 years. I've served with the National Board of Human Rights for a few years in Chicago. I've served with, I'm one of the co-founders of Multicultural Advisory Council to the FBI here in Oregon in South Washington. And I've gone through the Beaverton Police hearings and serve as one of the community advisors. And I also serve as the chairperson of our neighborhood association in Beaverton, located in the Murray Hill area. And my interest is to continue to serve. And by having a great diverse experience in service, I do believe that I would have something needed to add to this board if I'm confirmed. And my quest is to continue to serve humanity until I have no more life left. Having said that, I appreciate your time, and if there are any questions either you would like to address, I would be more than happy to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Harvey? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here this morning, and thank you for your willingness to serve this state.
Thank you, sir. Senators?
Close that public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Steve Clark to the TriMet Board. Mr. Clark, please state your name for the record. The reason I'm taking you a little bit out of order is we've had some pretty short reviews, and I have a feeling this one might yield some questions, so I'm trying to break it up a little bit. If there are questions, the questions probably won't be as much focused on you as they will be focused on the board that you want to serve on.
Thank you,
so
Senator.
Please state your name for the record and give us a brief overview.
Senator Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Steve Clark. I'm a resident of Tigard for the past 21 years and a lifelong Oregonian. My professional employment is I'm president and publisher of community newspapers in the Portland Tribune in the Portland area. Senators, for the past, I guess it's about 25 years, I've been involved in transportation issues throughout the region and throughout the state of Oregon, trying to serve as a citizen and as a business and community member to advocate and help to lead for investments in our infrastructure and our communities and our state. I feel that transportation matters and infrastructure contribute to healthy, safe communities as well as a vibrant economy and sustainable Oregon, not just in the Portland region, but throughout the state of Oregon. To be considered by your committee, the Senate, and to be appointed by the governor is a great honor. It helps to bring together what I learned and possibly through your leadership, members of the legislature, that it was time, beginning about this decade, that we stopped talking about transportation for transportation's sake and began engaging in leadership and investment for Oregon's sake. Many years ago, I started using the word outcomes instead of values to identify ways that we could invest in outcomes that would benefit our communities and our state. Many of you each have participated in that effort through your role as legislators. To serve on the TriMet board is an opportunity to address and help to lead to bring together people on numerous issues, not only efficiency of how we transport the economy and our people, but how we do so safely, how we engage in efficiency and transparency and accountability. The public has a right to know what we're doing and why it's beneficial to them before they engage in either use or support of. I think TriMet is at a nexus, not only in terms of its new general manager, but in terms of numerous issues, whether it's the Columbia River crossing, extension of light rail possibly to the Southwest Corridor, to Milwaukee, but most particularly of late in terms of how we manage the safety of the system and the dollars in which we manage buses and our employee group. My goal as a member of TriMet would be to serve that agency well and the region well, but to continue to encourage those of us that care about transportation, land use, the economy, the environment, to work together not in silos, but to bring us together in terms of outcomes that will benefit the region and the state of Oregon. I appreciate the chance to be with you today and look forward to any questions that you folks might have. Thank you.
Questions from the committee. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Steve, for being here today and for your willingness to serve on the board. I've spoken with Mr. Clark about some of the issues that we're going to talk about this morning. I think the first one would be just kind of a statement and then get your perspective on it, is that overall I've been disappointed in the TriMet board in that I don't see, as we have dealt with a number of issues both in operations, safety, and others, that they have really exercised their due diligence as a board to set the policy direction for management to execute. That it's, I think, more often than not, been kind of a rubber stamp of what management has done rather than exercise their fiduciary responsibility as a member of the board. I think first question would be, how do you view your role, Steve, in terms of as a member of this board, looking at the transportation goals of the region, as you mentioned, and TriMet specifically, in terms of your role versus management's role?
Thank you. Senator Devlin, Senator Metzger, as a board member, if you folks so choose, I believe my role and other board members would be to be actively engaged in establishing a review both of policy and strategic plans and opportunities and responsibilities for TriMet. I think that includes asking tough questions and posing questions about how is it that we do our job and how can we do it better. In about 1996, I was asked to chair a task force by TriMet to imagine how to improve suburban transit service, being a somewhat
not self-willed person, but not one that totally allows himself to be placed in boundaries. Under my leadership, the task force, Transit Choices for Livability, sought to imagine not just improvement of transit service for the suburban communities, but for the entire Portland area. And we really created a framework that sought to improve community-based transit throughout the region. I think at that time, members of staff initially thought this was pushback. But what they found was that the active engagement in the leadership of this task force sought to bring about opportunities for reevaluation and change that made TriMet a better entity. That would be my responsibility, I think, to serve as a question asker, to hold myself and others politely accountable, to seek to do things better for the sake of serving the public, to communicate effectively with the public and as appropriate to the members of the legislature.
Follow-up?
Yeah, a couple of follow-ups, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Steve. I want to talk a little bit about the area of safety. And this has, unfortunately, been kind of a headline issue with TriMet, both recently and in the past. In my Committee on Business and Transportation, put through a bill asking TriMet, after a number of light rail fatalities, to look at their safety. And what has come back, which has been frustrating, is it's generally looked at as environmental. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the culture of the operation of the drivers themselves. And I'll just give it a maybe try to make some type of comparison. If you're driving in Senator Farioli's district and you've got, you know, a lot of deer, as you would find on this, you know, hang around the side of the road, if one darts out and you hit it and you do a safety investigation, the result's going to be that it was unavoidable because the deer jumped out in front of you. But knowing that deer are likely to do that, it is actually possibly avoidable if you are cognizant of the circumstance and adjust whoever. And I'd say the same thing, like, say, with TriMet, if a child on a bicycle goes running across the, you know, maybe it's unavoidable if he does that, but you need to anticipate. And that's part of culture, a safety culture, as opposed to environmental changes. Despite some of the efforts we have made, and even some of the recent ones, as we do evaluations, invariably they come back as unavoidable. And if the driver thinks that everything's unavoidable, you're not going to have a culture of prevention. I kind of like to have you talk a little bit about safety in terms of how we might improve that, more than just looking at environmental issues or putting more cops on trains, but how do we create a culture of safety?
Senator Devlin, Senator Metzger, thank you for that question. I share with you a concern that safety is not an accident. Safety is a culture of responsibility. It's a culture that begins within TriMet and extends throughout the community, hopefully not to to deer. But I recall in 1998, October of 1998, shortly after the opening of Westside Light Rail, we had 3 to 4 very serious incidents involving fatalities along the West Side Line. And I wrote an editorial challenging the agency to take action to improve upon that. The response at that time was to compare TriMet's operational safety to Los Angeles. And my response was, I don't care about Los Angeles. Well, I really do, but I think we must care about Portland and the region. We must care about the citizens and the community. So how do you do that? I think it's by setting a standard that safety is paramount and it's not second nature. It is primary nature. To continue to ask both within the staff, within the management, and within the board and the community, how are we doing and can we do better? To never let it be an accident, but let it be an everyday focus. At work, I ask my employees several times a day, how are we doing on? And whatever that might be, some are unsettled by that question. Some anticipate that question and have a response and improve upon what I might have asked for or anticipated. So I think by remaining focused, by making safety a requirement of every employee, that I think when a question is asked, how are we doing on, we will have the answer, we will have the response. Safety changes. When I lived in Gresham, I don't think anyone could have anticipated the amount of traffic that would come from light rail. Traffic meaning passenger traffic. I don't think anyone would have hoped for the incidents that have occurred in that community. So I think we cannot be settled 20 years later to think that we're okay. We have to anticipate change and ask, how are we doing on? You would have my commitment that would remain a question of vigilance and action, not response. I think we must innovate and respond in advance, not after the fact.
Thank you. And I have one other
topic.
This legislature has allocated hundreds of millions of dollars in bonds, primarily for light rail, and most recently the South and then Milwaukee corridor, as well as the previous iterations to expand the service. And obviously that is set with an objective of providing more alternatives, transportation services. For those services to be actually delivered, it takes more than laying the rail. You have to be able to operate it. So every time we put a rail line in, we are obligating, in order to meet the goal, of providing services, personnel and the associated costs, trains, et cetera. And yet, TriMet has been pointed out, and I think even in your newspapers, is having an extremely high cost structure. And in fact, its benefit structure was labeled either the top or one of the top in the entire U.S., not just excellent, but excellent plus, plus, plus. Its health care costs, long-term health care costs, which have been questioned as to whether they're really figured into the long-term obligations of TriMet, are also extremely large. And yet, who pays for these services? It is the taxpayers, particularly the business taxpayers, who actually then pay for that service. And as you look to balance the budget, and you as a member now of the TriMet board, what we often see is, well, because of these costs, that we end up have to look at perhaps reducing services in order to pay these costs that have been incurred, which means it's counterproductive to what the goal is of providing that. That's a very tough situation. Once we have something, no one wants to give it up, you know, in terms of management and the employment relationship with the employees. But we also have to take, if we're going to provide the service, we also have to take this very broad look at how do we provide excellent personnel and benefits and costs without going overboard in which we're cutting services and asking someone else just to pay the tab, because obviously that increases then more long-term debt and it becomes a problem. In your business, you've had to do that. Every business has, but particularly in publishing, you have experience, and if you're going to provide the service of news, that you have to make some tough decisions. How do you see your role in trying to get the fiscal house of TriMet in order so that it benefits all parties, employers and employees, and the service community to which it has been entrusted to provide transportation service?
Thank you. Senator Devlin, members of the committee, Senator Metzger, I'll offer a few observations of things that I've done in the past, both with TriMet and externally. I think you are right that it is essential that a public agency represent both quality employment and fair and comparable benefits that allow it to operate effectively, efficiently, and safely in this case. But we have to recognize that in this day and age that we cannot go beyond, very far beyond, or even below what Oregonians comparably are receiving. I understand, although because I've not been appointed to the board yet, that negotiations are underway, and I would expect, if appointed to the board by your decision, that the entire contract would be subject to review and understanding. I think it's the ample opportunity for board members to ask tough questions when the offering I would have in comparison to how do I work I'll give you three brief examples. On transit choices for livability, at that time, TriMet was not in the practice of raising fare passenger rates. And we called upon the board to review them, if not every year, every 2 years, so that there would be a responsibility by citizens in the community to pay their fair share. And there was pushback at that time, but we said if it's an investment in public transit, public transportation, the public who is benefited by it should pay its fair share. And the TriMet board accepted that responsibility and took upon it, even though, as you well know, it's very difficult to have people before you ask you not to do something when they're 10 to 15 feet away from you. I'll offer another example. Most recently, as our state is contended with this very different economic time, we editorialized encouraging teachers' unions to accept rollbacks in their COLAs and their step increases, and pointed out the benefits of doing so and understanding fully well the difficulties, and advised instead of giving up an entire increase, we asked them to stay them for 6 months or a year and to allow that public agency that they work for the chance to review those so as to not cut teachers or services within a classroom. Many of the school districts we serve accepted that advice offered by ourselves and others, Beaverton for one, and did so. When you're writing editorials in which somebody could say, we don't like you and we're going to cancel your subscription, or we're going to go to your advertisers, we put ourselves at risk every day. I do that and do that with my best judgment. I think TriMet is a very fine agency that could be much better by working around what I would call the increments. It is operated efficiently by reducing its cost of operation and saving upwards of $10 million on its fleet. I think by finding additional increments and by fully examining contracts such as you have offered would be one of those responsibilities. And certainly payroll is not an increment. It's the majority of its cost. But you need to examine it fully and completely. And that would be my commitment to you in the Senate.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional questions?
Yes,
Mr. Senator Chair. Burdick.
Thank you. And thank you for your willingness to serve. This is a really demanding board, and, of course, you've done a lot of demanding things in the transportation area for your whole career. You live in a suburban community that I happen to represent, and so we both know what a sore point 99W is as it goes through Tigard. But in a broader sense, you know, when I first got elected, I heard all the time that the suburban communities felt that they were being taxed for TriMet, but they weren't getting the kind of service. And so I just wanted to get your perspective, since you do live in a suburban community, I certainly represent one. What is your perspective on where TriMet should be focusing when it comes to suburban communities like Tigard?
Thank you. Senator Devlin, Senator Berg, thank you very much. I do and have lived in just about every suburban community as well as grew up in North Portland, and except for Hillsborough. I think that TriMet is not necessarily only in the transportation business or the transit business specifically. It's in the community business. And Transit Choices for Livability and efforts that I have taken of late have been to emphasize that responsibility by not just having this typical spoke and wheel focus on transit, where Portland is the center of how transit runs, and to get to Beaverton through from Tualatin, you have to go to downtown Portland, then come back. We all understand the responsibility on moving over 100 million people a year, that you have to be efficient and cannot do everything. But I do believe, Senator, that there is a responsibility to continue to expand service between communities. Wes is an example of that, and we'll find out over time whether or not that's going to work. Bus service linking communities, Wes, light rail, and high-capacity transit is important. There is there is something that I think is a community that we need to address, however, and it's not just TriMet's responsibility. As an employer in the suburban community and in Portland, I think it's a responsibility for me to work with my employees and if appointed to the TriMet board, to work with other employers so that employers can encourage their employees and to some degree their customers to use transit where possible. If we don't do that, all we're going to do is pay a tax, and that's a pretty one-sided form of government. So my job, I think, would be to help to inspire businesses to engage in more fully utilizing transit services and to link communities. I think my responsibility also would be to work with local jurisdictions to improve upon that. But if, as a board member, I fail to do what we did with Transit Choices for Livability, which was to say that transit is community-based, not just spoke and wheel-based, I would fail what I did 10 years ago, 14 years ago, and I guarantee you I will not do that. I will continue to call upon us as a community, as in this case as a transit agency, to learn how to link communities so that the TriMet and other transportation entities will build communities, not just build bus, MAX, or West lines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up, one of the things that's very important to the City of Tigard and the mayor in particular is to have the West Side light rail extend out to 99W. And so I assume from what I'm hearing that would certainly be consistent with your vision.
Senator Devlin, Senator Brick, yes, it would be. In October, hosted a lunch and bus trip so that we could introduce folks along the 99W corridor, business people and community members, to the opportunities and the needs. I think everyone saw the need. Pacific Highway is really, it's like the Great Wall of China separating portions of those communities. And not that we have to put light rail down the middle of 99W, but there is an opportunity to bring focus and achievement, not disregard and disdain for 99W. Having lived there for 21 years, I know people who avoid it as they would the flu. I would like to make Pacific Highway a more robust community, a more robust economy, and a safer place to travel. And I think by effectively and completely looking at the opportunity to bring MAX to that area, we'll make a community along that corridor from downtown Portland to King City and possibly connecting Sherwood and Tualatin a richer, more vital place and a safer place.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Clark. We will take action on your appointment a little bit later, and thank you for your willingness to serve.
Senators, thank you very much.
Close that public hearing. I'm going to go backwards. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Tammy Bainey to the State Housing Council. Ms. Bainey, the basic routine here is for you to state your name for the record, to talk for a minute or two about your interest and background, and we'll see if there are any questions.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Tammy Bainey, and I'm a Deschutes County Commissioner, and I'm seeking the appointment to the Oregon Housing Council. But most importantly, I'm a mom, and I brought my daughter, Addie, behind me. She's 10. And our family friend, John Hawkins, who has a particular interest in government. And so they're skipping school today to learn about process. Thank you for entertaining both of them today as well. My background is in nonprofit work prior to being a county commissioner, and I feel very strong that through nonprofit work we can solve a lot of issues that government is not able to solve on their own. And so I really believe strongly in the partnership between the Oregon Housing Council and our local nonprofits and being able to address the housing issues that we are currently experiencing. I have been involved with the Oregon Housing Council and Mr. Merced in particular as the chair of the 10-year plan to end homelessness. And as you know, of course, we're not going to end homelessness, but if we don't start somewhere, we won't end anywhere either. So that work in particular particular is about bringing partners together and also the elected officials to talk about the issues that are happening in the communities, the gaps and needs that are needed to, in particular, be taken care of. And it's with particular interest that I really want to serve with the Oregon Housing Council because I think that they do great work. I have also served with the Habitat for Humanity in Bend, and I also sit on the Neighbor Impact Board, which is our community action group, and I chair the Emergency Services Committee, so see on a almost weekly basis of the need that we have in our community. As you may know, Deschutes County has been hit very hard, not only in our unemployment, but also in over-assessed values of our homes, and they have dropped well over 50% at this point, and I would tell you that there, but for by the grace of God, go I, and we are in this together. So being appointed to the committee would certainly warm my heart.
Any questions from Ms. Bainey? Seeing none, thank you for thank you for coming here today, and thank you for your guests coming here today.
Yes.
And we'll take action on your appointment a little bit later.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to see you.
Shall we try to go back? Close that public hearing. We will see. Mr. Holden, are you in the audience? Is there a Mr. Holden? If not, we'll come back. Okay, I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Scott Hall and Robert Pine to the Electrical and Elevator Board. Please proceed at your leisure.
Okay, Chair Devlin, committee members. My name is Scott Hall. I currently reside at 3155 Riverbend Avenue in Eugene, seeking a position on the State Electrical and Elevator Board. Lifelong Oregonian, I've been in the electrical business for well over 30 years, most of it in the wholesale side of things. Have an interest in codes and code adoptions. Mainly because most of my business, or has been in the past, design-build, working with contractors, which we work on developing plans and construction processes. Take pride in Oregon having a high standard of building codes, particularly in the electrical side of things. Look forward to maintaining that and being part of that in the future. And willing to take any questions if you have any.
Okay. We'll go to the next party, and then we'll go to questions.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Delvin, honorable senators, and my name's Robert Pine. I live in Boring, Oregon, and lived with there with my wife for 28 years and three daughters, and I'm seeking to also be on the board. It's your pleasure. I've been an elevator constructor for 28 years on the front lines, basically maintaining and installing the lifts, and currently on the JATC, which is the Apprenticeship Council with the state, and we do a lot of work with apprenticeship, and I'm also a teacher for the National Organization of Elevator Constructors, which I teach basic electricity and solid state. I'm an OSHA 500 trainer, so safety is paramount in our business, so hope to contribute some hands-on experience to the board.
Any questions for Mr. Hall or Mr. Pine? Well, I have a basic question. All the times that you watch movies or you see televisions where elevators fail and they... how confident are you in the safety mechanisms in elevators that they won't drop 54.
Oh, that'll help.
really never thought of it until right now, thank you.
they're real safe. They have a lot of backup safety mechanisms for those type of events that need to be checked periodically, and that's why we have the codes and these type of boards to make sure that these codes are enforced and checked out. Because if we don't check them, It has potential. You know, it's not as bad as TriMet, you know. but In some parts of the country where we do not have the enforcement as we do in Oregon and Washington, California, we're pretty strong, but we need to keep it that way because there are deaths and there's injuries, especially with escalators, very dangerous. Moving tons of people at a mall, if somebody came out with that concept to design a set of moving stairs with aluminum sharp edges everywhere that little kids can play on, I don't think that they would get off the ground in these days, you know, but yet we have them all the time now, and we have to make sure that they're safe as possible. So,
okay. Any additional?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that you made it clear that the broadcasts of the hearing are on the internet, so I hope somebody will post this last bit of testimony onto phobia.com.
And Mr. Chair,
raised everybody's awareness of possibilities.
Since you opened the door, Mr. Chair, what happens if you overload an elevator?
Well, nowadays we have a lot of safety mechanisms that test the weight before we even pick the brake and try to run. So we just politely tell the people to get off. That we can't handle that kind of load.
Who tells them?
We have a little annunciator on our new elevators that tell us, please exit, we're overloaded. So that's nice. Now, the older ones, we have other mechanisms that we won't try to run. We'll shut the door, we'll just park you, but we'll trap you. We'll keep you in there until a technician comes out to let you out.
Okay, I'm not eating anything for 2 weeks.
Mr. Chairman, while we have the applicants here, maybe we should ask them to check out the house wing, because I've heard that their elevators don't go all the way to the top.
Very good.
With that, thank you very much for coming here today, and thank you for your willingness to serve.
Thank you.
And your sense of humor.
I will close that public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Eric Larson to the Employment Appeals Board. Mr. Larson.
Senator Devlin, members of the committee, first of all, let me make one point, which is that was a hard act to follow. I always wondered about the elevators myself. So, my name is Eric Larson, and my address is 1483 35th Avenue Northwest here in Salem, Oregon. I'm a member of the Employment Appeals Board, and this would be my second four-year term on the Employment Appeals Board. It's been a good transition for me in my professional life. I worked as a circuit court pro tem judge for a number of years, and I was in private practice for about 24, 25 years before that, and worked as the presiding judge for the city of Kaiser for about 9 years while I was in private practice. I've enjoyed the opportunity to serve the public on the board, and want to thank you for the opportunity to come in and testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have, so feel free.
Okay. For the sake of the audience, the reason Mr. Larson is appearing for reappointment is not because any member of the Senate had a question, but because
I wondered about that.
Because his position is paid, and all paid appointments appear before the committee for both their initial appointment and reappointment. Any questions?
Is this the same board on which former Senator Tony Corcoran serves?
Yes, it is.
I'm sorry.
I can't say I was anticipating that question, but I don't know. So, Ms. Corcoran represents labor. I represent public, and Sarah Lenz represents management on the board, is how it's set up. And he still is on the board, so.
Yeah, we miss him in this building.
So. I'll pass that on to him.
We do.
Okay.
Any additional? If not, thank you very much for your willingness to continue to serve.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Close that public hearing. Opening a public hearing on the appointment of Linda Saffetti to the State Board of Higher Education.
Good morning, Chair Devlin and the members of the committee. My name is Linda Saffetti, and my address is 2017 Northwest Myrtlewood Way, Corvallis, Oregon. I am currently a professor and head of the Department of Botany and Plant Pathology at Oregon State University, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today. Actually, after very serious consideration and reflection, and due to my ardent support for higher education in Oregon, I have accepted the nomination because I do believe that I can provide and contribute to the important mission and goals of the Board of Higher Ed. Specifically, when we refer to providing access and affordable, high-quality education to the people of Oregon, I'm dedicated to the development and to the delivery of high-quality education in the state of Oregon such that we can attract, retain our best and our brightest students and faculty, as well as those from out of state and internationally. I have been a faculty member at Oregon State University, involved in teaching, research, service, and outreach for the past 20 years. I have participated in multiple levels of shared governance at the university, most recently in terms of my role as Faculty Senate President for 16 months, and on many committees across the campus. I feel that I can provide the board a perspective garnered from my extensive experience with students, faculty, staff, and leadership at the university level. I am honored to be having been nominated by the governor for this appointment, and I ask the Senate Committee on Rules for your support. Thank you for the opportunity again to testify before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Tufet?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
You know, the higher ed has really taken the brunt of our budget problems dating clear back to the passage of Measure 5. And as we proceed, you know, from cycle to cycle, tuition keeps going up, and access, of course, goes down when tuition goes up. But we kind of find ourselves in a spot where we're sort of balancing tuition increases versus financial aid for the very most needy students. And I just want to get a sense from you of where you feel the priority should be in lowering tuition for everyone or in trying to focus on the neediest students.
Chair Devlin, Senator Burdick, that's a very interesting question. May I give you a little bit of background? I'm not from Oregon. I came to Oregon 20 years ago. And we actually came here because this was actually our first job offers. And we took the positions here because we saw and felt that the people of Oregon and, of course, Oregon State University, because that's where we were looking at, had a passion for higher education. And since we got here, right after we got here for 20 years, the funds and the contributions to higher ed continued to decrease. I think it's a very tricky situation in terms of it's a balancing act, and I don't have a silver bullet here, but it's a balancing act in terms of providing enough tuition in order that the system can support itself, because we don't get the funds that we need to support in terms of the state dollars that has decreased constantly, as you mentioned. Yet we need to make this affordable to all of the students in Oregon. And so my opinion is, I think we need to look at this actually as a systems problem. It's not just a higher ed problem. In my opinion, it's a systems problem in terms of K-220. And collectively, we have to raise the standards, and collectively, we have to deal with the situation. I am fully in favor, if tuitions are raised, I am fully in favor of funds to be provided for access. I think that's the only way that we can do it if tuitions are going to be raised. And so that would be my answer at this time to you. If you want to follow up, if I didn't clarify what your concerns were, I'd be happy to do so.
Well, if I could just follow up just very briefly, one of my concerns is I think we do a reasonable job of, you know, picking out the highest need kids. And then, of course, the wealthy kids, you know, they can tolerate the tuition increases. There are a lot of kids in the middle who are not quite poor enough to get in under that bar and certainly are not wealthy enough. And I just wonder if you've given any thought as to how we can deal with that situation.
Chair Devlin and Senator Burdick, yes, I'll follow up on that. Actually, I completely understand what you mean, and I think a lot of those types of students do actually end up doing work-study types of jobs to help pay for their tuition, and there is an added element. At least I can talk from Oregon State University's perspective and our department. There are many types of scholarships that are available, and I do know even with more emphases being talked about to bring those scholarships to reality. And many of those scholarships aren't just for the lowest income students. They also bring into account a student's ability, a student's performance, and they hit upon a lot of the mid-range students. And I agree with you 100%. Those are the ones that mid-range, in terms of an economic level, are the ones that fall through the cracks. And so I think with creativity, and I think with added scholarship types of monies from donors, et cetera, I do think that we can not allow for that group of students to fall through the cracks, because I think it's critically important. And having been one of those students myself, many, many years ago, being brought up by a single mom who had her own business, I found that exact same thing. There was nothing for me because she had her own business, yet she really couldn't afford the education. So I'm very sensitive to that issue, but I think that we have to be aware of it, as you say, and we have to make efforts to make sure that group of students don't fall through the cracks.
Thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here today.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Close that public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Charles Krakenberg and Roger Graham to the Oregon Board of Accountancy. Please, whoever would like to start.
Chair Devlin and members of the committee, my name is Roger Graham. I am honored to be nominated for the Board of Accountancy. I live in Corvallis, Oregon. I live at 589 Northwest Cervista Avenue. I am a professor of accounting at Oregon State University. I have been a professor there for the last 20 years. I began my career in Oregon by going to the University of Oregon, of all places, and then moved to Oregon State. I'm the program director of the accounting program at Oregon State University. I've developed accounting programs. I'm starting to develop another one, so I've been involved in developing accounting programs. I think from my perspective, I have a vested interest in maintaining the integrity of the accounting program, accounting profession, and that's why I'm very excited to be nominated for this position. I would be the public member of the board, and I, as my role to protect the interests of the people of Oregon, and with my vested interest in protecting the profession, I'm also quite interested in ensuring access to the profession and ensuring that students will be adequately prepared for the accounting profession. So thank you very much for letting me speak today.
Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Charles Allen Krakenberg. I reside in Newburgh, Oregon, and with your support, I'd like to serve on the Oregon Board of Accountancy. I believe my professional qualifications suit me to serve on that board. I've been licensed as a public accountant since 1986, and I've also been licensed... My speaking seems to get the opera going and people are leaving here. I've also been licensed by the IRS as an enrolled agent since 1983. I graduated from George Fox University in 1979 with a degree in economics and business, and I also served in the United States Air Force for 4 years. During that time, I'd like to note that my section was so small, I never outranked anyone. in the 4 years that I was in the service. I primarily serve small business owners and individual taxpayers with their various and sundry accounting issues. I believe this combination that I have of kind of looking from the bottom up and professional qualifications are going to serve the citizens of Oregon and State Board of Accountancy well. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today, and if you have any questions, if any of you are left that have any questions, I'd be glad to address them.
Okay. Any questions, Senator Perry?
No, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you very much for appearing here today. We'll take action on your appointments just a little bit later. Close that public hearing. Opening a public hearing on the appointments of John Haroldson and Judith Parker to the Commission on Hispanic Affairs.
Did we ever get the person we skipped?
Please proceed in whichever order you choose. And
thank you. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Judith Parker, and I reside at 2662 Northwest Kennedy Court in Portland, 97229. I work for Hinshaw & Culbertson as an attorney, and I am on the board of directors for the Oregon Hispanic Bar Association. I'm very excited about the opportunity to serve as a commissioner for the Oregon Commission on Hispanic Affairs. As a Latina and an Oregonian, I have been passionate about the advocacy for Latinos in Oregon since working for Congresswoman Hooley a decade ago, even before I went to law school across the street. And as an attorney, I've been active every year, but I've been a licensed bar member of the National Hispanic Bar and the local bar association as well for Hispanic issues. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Mr. Haroldson.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, and to the committee members. My name is John Haroldson. I live at 7555 Northwest Hoodview Circle in Corvallis, Oregon. I am the district attorney for Benton County here in the state of Oregon. I have been a criminal prosecutor for 22 years. I began as an intern in the city of Albany, and I've stayed in the Mid-Willamette Valley, and I have been working in Corvallis now for 7 years. The commitment that I have is one that is born of my own life's journey. I am a Mexican-American. My full name is John Haroldson Suarez Gutierrez Ballesteros de Lara. Spanish is my first language. I have lived in both countries, and I believe that I can share some insights with respect to the experience of facing great challenges, having academic success, and being able to really work in collaborative efforts in order to create opportunities that are equal for everyone. I have been committed in my work with the United States Hispanic Leadership Institute, with the 4-H program at Oregon State University, as well as the CAMP program at Oregon State University. My wife and I have worked in supportive and presenting roles with young Latinos from elementary, junior high, high school, and we'll continue in those efforts as it is a lifetime passion for us. I appreciate greatly having this opportunity to be considered as a commissioner, and would be more than happy to answer any question you might have. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Haroldson or Mr. Parker? Thank you very much for appearing here today. We'll take action in a few minutes. Close that public hearing. Open a public hearing on the appointments of Mr. Chowdhury and Mr. Farthing to the Board of Medical Imaging. And we will go to Mr. Jacob Abraham as the third party when we get them on the telephone. Please proceed.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dr. David Farthing. I've been an imaging physician for over 27 years. I'm board certified in both diagnostic radiology and in neuroradiology. I've had experience in training programs. I work both in the Indian Health Service, the Public Health Service, as well as private practice, and in in a hospital environment. I'm familiar with training of various different types of technologists that are utilized in imaging. I live and work here in Salem. Any questions?
Okay. Well, we'll go to Mr. Chowdhury first, and then we'll see if there are any questions.
Thank you. Chairman Senator Richard Devlin and members of the committee. I, AKM Shastri Chowdhury, I live in 2395 Northwest Jasmine Way, Portland, Oregon 97229. And I have been nominated as a member of the Medical Imaging Board as a public member. Just to mention my background a little bit, I came from Bangladesh. It's a smaller country in the Southeast Asia. And all the way up here in Portland, I live in Oregon for almost 11 years. I was graduated in material science and engineering and received my master's and PhD in material science and electronic engineering, respectively, focusing in electronic materials and device. Currently, I'm employed as a senior staff member of Logic Technology Development in Intel Corporation. That's located in Hillsboro, Oregon. I hold many U.S. patents and has many significant scientific contributions in silicon technology. I'm also the founding president of Encore International, a nonprofit organization, and have done many volunteer projects for local schools. My goal was to give them math and science education to the local needy kids. Although I have very limited knowledge in medical science, because my profession is different, I came from silicon technology background. But my hard work, knowledge, and educational background will keep my quality learned. And then I'd be quickly learning the board expectation in that direction, basically based on my knowledge and education I have. Excuse me. I feel lucky that I have been given the opportunity to serve the state, and I'll do my best to do so. And being nominated as a public member of the Medical Imaging Board, I strongly recognize that my role is in protecting the public interest. Thank you, Mr. Chairman Devlin, and members of the committee, to give me the opportunity to testify before you, and now I'll be asking for questions.
Any questions for Mr. Farthing or Mr.
No, Mr. Chairman, just to recognize that it's always good to have family members attend with the applicant.
I do, and actually my wife also works for Intel. She's a software engineer. And the little kids you have seen there, he actually wanted to see how this process go. He actually in the second graders. And I'm also honored that my mother-in-law is here with me also. Thank you.
Well, we don't have many people bring, maybe not the entire family, but the immediate family.
They are most welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no additional questions, thank you both for coming here today, and we'll take action on your appointments a little bit later.
Thanks very much.
Close that public hearing. And I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Bruce Dobbs to the Residential and Manufactured Structures Board.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Bruce Dobbs. I live at 2882 Northwest Fairfax Terrace in Portland, 97210. I'm honored to sit here before you and offer my credentials to be on the State Residential Board. I am just leaving after 8 years of service on the non-residential board, and as you know, I have been nominated to be on the residential board. My experience is, as mentioned, the non-residential structures board. I'm a registered mechanical engineer. I'm a supervisor of new construction at Northwest Natural. I'm on the faculty in the engineering department at PSU, on the U.S. Green Building Council Higher Education Committee, and on the State Energy Committee. I feel that I really it can bring a lot to the party in terms of sitting on the residential board, in that my expertise is in energy efficiency, and I think that I can represent the utilities of the Northwest plus the citizens of the Northwest in regards to ensuring that at this critical time that we're offering sustainable opportunities for the public in terms of wind energy, solar energy, combined heat and power, and other types of sustainability. I'll be glad to entertain any questions.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Dobbs? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming
thank
here today,
you.
And we'll take action on your appointment a little bit later in the morning.
Thank you.
Close that public hearing. Opening a public hearing on the appointment of Lindsay Duffus and Jenny Price to the State Board of Speech, Language, Pathology, and Audiology.
All right, good morning. Are we waiting for Jenny?
There you go.
She's
go
there,
ahead.
Okay. Senator Devlin, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come before you today. My name is Lindsay Duffus. I reside in Beaverton, Oregon. I'm a pediatric audiologist at the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center at OHSU. And the main reason why I wanted to be on this board was I have a real passion for ensuring that our my pediatric patients are well cared for. And there's not a huge pediatric representation, I don't think, on this board. Especially there hasn't been in the field of audiology. And as many of you know, Oregon recently passed a law requiring private insurance companies to pay for hearing aids for children. So there'll be a lot of audiologists in the state now who will be needing to fit children with hearing aids, but also provide them with important and detailed diagnostic care. And many audiologists are not trained in the evaluation of children. And so that's a passion of mine, and I want to ensure that those audiologists in Oregon are doing that appropriately, because testing children is extremely different than testing in adults, and not a lot of people understand that. So that's my main goal, and I appreciate you hearing me, and I can answer any questions.
And we will go to Ms. Price first, and then we'll see if there are any questions.
Okay.
Ms. Price?
Yes.
If you could please state your name for the record and give us 1 or 2 minutes of testimony on your background and interest in serving on the State Board of Speech, Language, Pathology, and Audiology.
Sure. Good morning. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak with you by telephone. My name is Jenny Price, and I currently reside in Pendleton, Oregon. I'm a speech-language pathologist, and also I'm currently working as a coordinator of the speech-language and regional programs from UMatillamora USC. I'm seeking to be appointed to the Oregon Board of Examiners, as was mentioned before, for the speech-language and audiology services. This is just a different side of the speech-language pathology and audiology field that I am interested in learning more about. As a speech-language pathologist living here in rural or eastern Oregon, I'm hoping that I can maybe bring a different perspective of the ongoing SLP shortages and the customer issues that arise around the state. I'm just very excited to be part of this, and again, just as a learning experience, I think it's going to not only help me professionally but also personally. So thank you for that. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you both for appearing here today, and we will take action on your appointments a little bit later.
Thank you.
I will close that public hearing, open a public hearing on the appointment of Benjamin Eckstein to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Benjamin Eckstein. I'm a second-year student at the University of Oregon. I'm excited and honored to have the opportunity to serve our state on the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. My interest in serving as a commissioner is derived First, for my commitment to ensuring access to an affordable and quality post-secondary education for all Oregonians, and second, my priority of effectively representing my fellow students as a student commissioner. I've already worked to familiarize myself with OSAC. I've met with current commissioners, attended the most recent commission meeting, and researched the programs that OSAC administers. I anticipate a lot of work. I am ready for the challenge, and I look forward to serving. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, any questions? Well, thank you for coming here this morning. We appreciate your willingness to serve, and I think you're well aware that the commission is going to face some significant challenges in the coming years.
Yeah.
Thank you. Close that public hearing. Opening a public hearing on the appointment of Rosemary Pryor to the Oregon Workforce Investment Board.
And just as Ms. Pryor comes up, I just want to take note for the committee that we did receive letters of support from Representative Nathanson and Representative Holby, and they were made available to all the members of the Senate.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Rosie Pryor. I reside at 2671 East Wilshire Drive in Eugene, Oregon, and I'm currently Vice President for Marketing and Human Resources and Strategic Planning for Oregon Community Credit Union in Eugene. We're chartered to serve 10 counties in Oregon. For the past 7 years, I've had the opportunity to serve as a member of the Lane Workforce Partnership Board of Directors. That's our local workforce board in Lane County, and I'm wrapping up my second year as chair of the board. I'm interested in serving on the Workforce Investment Board for two reasons. As a private employer, I care deeply about the quality of the applicant pool that we see each time we have openings in our place of employment. And as a potential investment board member, I would have the opportunity to continue to help Oregon make efficient use and optimize precious federal employment and state employment and training dollars. So I would welcome the opportunity to answer questions.
Any questions for Ms. Pryor? Well, thank you very much, Ms. Pryor, for staying here and for coming to this hearing. As you can see, our hearing room is usually how they are when we get to the end of the process in terms of the executive appointments. Starts full, and then it gets down to a few interested parties and a few lobbyists looking for a place to sit.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And they may be interested in the proceedings also. Close the public hearing. Opening a public hearing on the appointment of Diane Lavelle to the Board of Directors of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. This will be by phone. Okay, Ms. Lavelle, if you'll state your name for the record and speak to us for a minute or two about your interest and background in serving on the Patient Safety Commission.
Hi. My name is Diane Lovell, and I work for Oregon AFSCME, and I'm a member of the PEBIS Board, Public Benefits Board. And I'm very interested in serving in this capacity because it aligns with many of the PEB goals, which is improving healthcare outcomes in general, but more specifically, making sure that we get value and safety in our purchasing for state employees. And I think the Patient Safety Commission, I mean, this is the primary goal. I think it also aligns with our new policies with the Oregon Healthcare Authority and what we're trying to reach. And I believe I have some background in that area, but I also think that I will be able to learn what's going on in terms of safety and integrate that into the PEP programs. And those programs also integrate into the Oregon Educators Benefit Board because the two boards be in very, very close alignment and touch. So I think that I have something to offer and much to learn.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for appearing here by telephone. We'll take action on your appointment in a few minutes.
Thank you, Ben.
close the public hearing, opening a public hearing on the appointment of Cynthia Homan to the Commission for Women. Ms. Homan?
Yes, this is she.
If you please state your name for the record and talk to us for a minute or two about your background and interest in serving on the Commission for Women.
Okay, thank you, Chair Devlin, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cynthia Homan, and I reside at 175 Northwest 16th Street in Bend, Oregon. And I'm interested in serving on the Commission for Women because I am committed to the policies and mission of this committee. And I'm especially concerned with the challenges that are facing mothers that are balancing families and demands of the workplace, and I would like the opportunity to advocate for those policies to help them. I'm also interested in supporting more women in elected offices and appointed positions, and I have volunteered in the past on women's political campaigns. I have lived in Bend, Oregon for 8 years, and I feel one thing I can bring to this commission is geographic diversity, since many of the appointments are on the other side of the state. So I like the opportunity to bring forward concerns from Central Oregon and where I live. I will to keep this brief, so that kind of wraps up my interest. And thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any.
Okay, any questions for Ms. Homan? Seeing none, thank you very much for appearing here this morning, and we'll take action on your appointment in a few minutes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you. Okay, which point? Okay. Close that public hearing. Open a public hearing on the Board of Medical Imaging and the appointment of Jacob Abraham. Mr. Abraham?
Yes.
If you would please state your name for the record and just talk to us for a minute or two about your interest in serving on the Board of Medical Imaging.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. My name is Jacob Abraham. I'm a physician with Columbia Cardiology Associates in Portland, Oregon. Our address is 9427 Southwest Barnes Road, Suite 498. We are on the campus of St. Vincent's Hospital, which is part of the Providence Health System. My interest in serving on the Medical Imaging Committee stems from the fact that I have experience with multiple modalities of imaging, including CT, cardiac MRI, and ultrasound, and I think that it's very important that technicians and technologists be held to a high standard, both because of the growth of medical imaging, as well as the potential risks that are involved with imaging, including radiation exposure, contrast administration, as well as risks of under- and over-diagnosis that could occur should these tests be used inadequately or the tests are not performed to a high standard.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Abraham? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Abraham, for appearing here via telephone. We'll take action on your appointment in a few minutes.
Thank you.
Okay. Committee members, please don't leave. We're going to go to recess for like 60 seconds to see if our last person to interview is listening to a hearing next door. And then we'll probably go to the normal motions.
We'll get Senator Atkinson on the phone, yes.
the record and give us a brief 1 or 2 minutes on your background and your interest in serving on the State Board of Denture Technology.
My name is Ken, or Kenneth Holden. I've been a denturist for 30-plus years. I've served previously on the board and have always been interested in the profession and maintaining the attention, credibility, and advancing it.
Any questions for Mr. Holden? Hearing none, thank you very much for appearing here by telephone. We'll take action on your appointment momentarily.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll get Senator Atkinson, and then we'll get Senator Burdick back in the room.
We'll be appointing Atkinson.
Close that public hearing.
Okay, it's all rolled into one.
Yeah.
I'll give you an alternative if I have any notes on the names online.
Okay.
Want to do the voice now? Okay.
I'll open a work session on moving the following appointments and reappointments of the following boards and commissions to the Senate floor with the recommendation that they be confirmed en bloc. Charles Krakenberg and Roger Graham to the Oregon State Board of Accountancy. C. Lane Borg and Ann Liniger to the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. Christopher Kohrich and Joe Smith to the State Board of Aviation. Phyllis Harris John, Phyllis Rand, Samara Stone, and Lorraine Wilson to the Commission on Black Affairs. Joyce Green, Ann Isholsworth, Richard Fay, and Jody Roth to the Commission for the Blind. Eric Anderson and Vincent Leedy to the Board of Boiler Rules. Gregory Nelson to the Building Code Structures Board. Neela Epstein, Linda Gray, Julie Smith to the Board of Licensed Counselors and Therapists. John Chet Tess to the Trust for Cultural Development Board, Alton Harvey to the Oregon Board of Dentistry, Kenneth Holden to the State Board of Denture Technology, Thomas Fair, Scott Hall, Thomas Lindberg, Daniel Marr, Dennis Perkins, Robert Pine to the Electrical Elevator Board, Eric Larson to the Employment Appeals Board, Barry Baylor to the Energy Facility Siting Council, John Waller to the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, Rachel Pill Iod to the OHSU Board of Directors, Bruce Abernathy to the Health Services Commission, Linda Chaffetti to the State Board of Higher Education, John Harrelson and Judith Parker to the Commission on Hispanic Affairs, Roxy Mayfield to the Home Care Commission, Tammy Bainey and Michael Fieldman to the State Housing Council, Aletha Bonebrake to the Trustees of the State Library, Carol Zancellanella to the State Board of Licensed Social Workers, Robert Rice to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, William Bard to the Long-Term Care Advisory Committee, Jeffrey Krug and Ann McIntyre to the Oregon State Board of Maritime Pilots, Craig McMillan and Melanie Morin to the State Board of Massage Therapists, Guy Sperg to the Mechanical Board, Jacob Abraham, Shastagir Shuduri, David Farthing to the Board of Medical Imaging, Michelle Homer Anderson to the Board of Naturopathic Examiners, Sharon Van Eaton to the Nursing Home Administrators Board, Donna Kane and Rebecca Urbelau to the Oregon State Board of Nursing, Kay Reich to Lynn Reichlin to the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board, Davis Morici to the State Parks and Recreation Commission, Diane Lavelle to the Board of Directors of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, Jonathan Gray and Jack Villendre to the State Plumbing Board, Ken Allen to the Board of Commission of the Port of Portland, Todd Anderson, Kent Barker, Stuart Roberts, Joseph Siebert, Scott Stanton to the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training, Bruce Dobbs, Catherine Gray, Douglas Lathan to the Residential and Manufactured Structures Board, Lindsay Dufus, Jenny Price, Elisa Williams to the State Board of Speech, Language, Pathology, and Audiology, Benjamin Eckstein to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, Linda Brown to the Teacher Standard Practices Commission, Stephen Clark to the TriMet Board, Emily Gilliland, Eva Schweiber to the Oregon Volunteer Commission for the Voluntary Action Service, Cynthia Holman to the Commission for Women, Rosemary Pryor to the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Burdick, will you carry?
I'd be honored, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Burdick will carry. That concludes the business of the committee for today. I believe we will be back in session in September.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.